I want to talk to you about, as President Bourne has said, the visual response of artists to this critical period in American history. And I'm going to concentrate, say, 1855 to 1865, because there's a paradox here. American artists didn't really illustrate the Civil War. I think, certainly in American history, it's the first time during the course of major conflicts, the Revolutionary War, War of 1812, for example, we have major examples of artists who depicted battle scenes, who depicted the great heroes. With a few exceptions, that simply didn't exist during the Civil War. So there's a real question here. First of all, to try and answer why, and then secondly, how did they respond? How did they express the deep anguish, the turmoil, the kinds of issues we've heard about so eloquently this morning? So let me start, and if we can lower the lights, that would probably help. I just made the point that in the Revolutionary War period, we produced really a major artist in John Trumbull, a patriot who studied in England, and really became sort of the official artist of the Revolutionary War. And I just give you an example there on the left, General Mercer's death at the Battle of Princeton, one of a whole series. And of course, it is Trumbull who also depicted the group coming together to sign the Declaration of Independence. There are others that depict, as I said, the major names, the faces, and some of the key events of the period. On the right hand is a battle scene on Lake Erie that Thomas Birch painted in the contemporary and shortly after, in the teens and the 20s, a series depicting the major naval battles in the War of 1812. And as I said, the curious thing is we have almost no equivalent in the American Civil War. Yes, we could cite Winslow Homer, the Boston artist, comes to New York. He's hired by Harper's Magazine as a kind of staff illustrator, is sent to the front from New York to depict mostly scenes and images behind the battle lines. I just show you one of the more important examples, the rebel sharpshooter there up in a tree, which was also a little oil painting, one of his first, actually in the 1860s. And so Harper is a kind of journalist recorder, but by and large, and even in this case, they're not scenes of outright action itself. There's something quite startling, of course, capturing this relatively new form of terror, namely the sharpshooter in a tree, taking bead on an partly seen or unseen enemy. And so literally and metaphorically, the action is outside the screen of the frame of reference here. At the end of the war in 1866, Homer painted this great picture on the right, known as Prisoners from the Front, now in the Metropolitan Museum. But it, too, is not a scene of action. It's not the moment itself. It is after the war when the bedraggled Confederate soldiers are lined up on the left-hand side facing the young Northern Union officer on the right. And in a sense, we begin to feel that the meaning in this picture is not in what's depicted, but what's not. The drained, empty, barren, scorched landscape surrounding them. The fact that the painting is largely monochromatic, that also suggests something about the palette, suggesting something about the drama of life and death that is implied here. The effort at reconciliation, such as it is or isn't. But as I say, this is after the war itself. There are a few other pictures one could cite. I'm not going to show you. Albert Bierstadt did a little skirmish in the wood. It's not a big picture, not a major one. I'm just the Southern artist, an artist named John Ross Key, painted a major picture called The Bombardment of Fort Sumter. And so one could hold that up, perhaps, as a key American picture of the conflict. Conrad Wise Chapman recently rediscovered another Southern painter who depicted largely army tents and various scenes, but largely, as I say, behind the battle lines themselves. So this brings us back then to my opening question, why? And why not, the other part of that question. Well, I think there are maybe three reasons, at least I can think of. The first, interesting, and I just throw this out for us to think about, is that this was a period in which the cultural response to this growing period of turmoil and then outright conflict, and by that I mean the late 1850s and then the 1860s itself, was perhaps most expressed in our literature of the period. There are moments in history, in American history, when this is the case. The 1960s, I think, is quite interesting to me in that black expression, the African-American outrage at race relations and so forth, was largely expressed through literature. There's very little significant African-American painting or sculpture in that period, because the memoir, it seems to me, to a lesser extent poetry, but the memoir and the autobiography became the major outlet for that aspect of public expression. I want to argue that this same period, that is say the period of the Civil War, the antebellum and then the war period itself, also produces some of our greatest literature in the history of the country, what is now known as the American Renaissance. But in particular, the key figures like Harriet Beecher Stowe, and then later Whitman, and especially Melville, to a lesser extent, much more metaphorically, Henry David Thoreau in Boston. It was in the great production of their masterworks of writing that you have, quote, artists in the largest sense, looking for means of response, of anticipation, and then response. So I would say that literature is perhaps one answer. The second, perhaps more crucial, is photography, and I think we forget this. Photography only recently developed, that is to say, the procedures literally only discovered and formulated in the late 1830s, introduced to this country, the daguerreotype in particular, and then the next important development, the so-called glass plate positive-negative techniques, which still required large moments of holding the lens open, so they couldn't photograph motion. But in the case of the U.S., the Civil War provided the first opportunity for photographers to photograph imagery of the battlefield. As I say, because of exposure time, they couldn't depict motion. So again, we're looking at images of dead soldiers, images that in some cases are literally composed or recomposed. That is to say, in Timothy O'Sullivan photograph on the right, Home of the Rebel Sharpshooter, we now know that that body had been photographed outside the rocky outcroppings and been brought in and lodged in the rocks here in the lower foreground, so that the photographer is actually thinking like a painter composing. It is meant to have all the directness and the obviously the gravity, the immediacy of the horror itself. And in a way, I think, just to argue that photography took over that artistic role, and of course, initially, the first decade or so after its development, particularly in Europe, there were, among artists and the academies, the belief that painting, quote, painting was dead, and that photography had taken on a level of realism that painters had been aspiring to for generations. So photography, it seems to me, plays a major role in answering that question. And the body of work produced by O'Sullivan, and there on the left, Alexander Gardner, some of these attributions have shifted. Both were assistants and have been working with the great Matthew Brady. Brady largely worked behind the scenes, produced an extraordinary body of work. If any of you saw the major exhibition last year, both of paintings at the Metropolitan, but there was also the Met put on a photography show of photography during the Civil War, showing many of this great series of pictures. There was also startling imagery. We heard this morning about amputation. The medical photographs are absolutely riveting from this period. So photography would be a second answer to the question. And the third is, it seems to me, American landscape. By the 1820s, 1830s, landscape really became the new imagery in defining national identity in literature and in painting. In literature, with the writings certainly of Ralph Waldo Emerson, nature being the most familiar one, and then of his student, his pupil, and later great friend, Henry David Thoreau, articulate nature as the great American experience. The country was beginning to be opened up, population was moving to the middle of the country, and then with the discovery, of course, of gold in 1849, it wasn't just the eastern half of the country, it was the country envisioned, set in motion by Jefferson's Louisiana Purchase and the Lewis and Clark expedition to follow, set in motion then the idea of America being something more than coastal, being a continental idea, a territorial idea, an idea that could be shown primarily in landscape. And so nature, by the second quarter of the 19th century, and this is really the heart of the argument, it seems to me, by the second quarter of the 19th century, nature is the embodiment of national identity. Nature becomes, Perry Miller said, we are nature's nation. The sense of not only identity, but of national history is expressed, to put the, in the phrase, to me is expressed in the horizon. The idea of looking west, the idea of looking to the setting sun, twilight hours, the setting sun, becomes one of the great images of American landscape beginning in the second quarter and carrying through through our period. So I want to talk, in effect, paradoxically, about artists, as I say, who don't depict literally the Civil War or the tensions leading up to it. But I want to try, and this is a subtle argument, because I'm really talking about what's not there. But if you accept the premise that landscape, as I say, is, for all intents and purposes, during this really half century from 1825 to 1875, is landscape, we need now to look closely at landscape painting in this very precise focus period. And I want to make an argument that there you will see a profound and deep insight into the state of the nation as it went through this crisis. I'm going to concentrate briefly on three artists. Not all exact contemporaries. The first is an artist I've worked on for years, FitzHenry Lane, born in Gloucester, basically a New England artist, largely centered in Massachusetts, Boston, and the coast of Maine, beginning, born in 1804, comes into his maturity in the 1820s and 30s, an active painter in the 40s and 50s. So he is, and he dies actually in 1865, at the end of the Civil War. And there's something very poignant about his final years coinciding with the great crisis of warfare itself. I'll come to that, you'll see in a moment. But I begin with some of his most beautiful pictures painted in the late 1840s and particularly early 1850s. He develops a style we now call luminism, a term obviously referring to the emphasis on light. And it's one of the most beautiful aspects, I think, about Lane's achievement is that he could express Yes, details of the landscape, but as the career moves on, there is less and less emphasis, for example, on the foreground, on the literal ground itself. We are increasingly drawn, for example, here, these are two views of Gloucester. First on the shore, this is about 1850, with some sense of naval marine activity there in the background, telling us something about maritime economy, the growth of trade along the New England coast, et cetera, et cetera. But in this painting of about 1852, 53 on the right of, it's believed to be Gloucester Harbor, we know that from the little island on the right, but largely speaking, you can't tell where you are. You're looking at open light. Lane has begun to draw your attention to the middle ground and to the distance, to what I'd love to call the poetry of light itself, moving painting, as it were, from the prose of nature to the poetry of nature, the sense of economy, of distillation, of implication. So if Emerson had taught us that God's presence was imminent in nature, Lane, as his contemporary, is suggesting in the open, radiant sky, the literal depiction of broad, open sunlight at midday and mid-morning, that this is sort of America at a moment of apogee, this great period before the Civil War, that sense of optimism for a brief time before it was challenged by regional conflict, challenged by technology, the railroads, etc., the belief that American civilization did have God's ordination in it. So the open skies, the radiant sunlight, the stillness of water. Elaine is a great economist in composition, this beautiful sense of the alignment of vessels across the canvas itself, horizontals and verticals, the play of radiating sunlight there, the fact that clouds have disappeared. He learned to paint with just thin glazes, so that literally the canvas, as I say, suggests a kind of transparency into another world. And so God's presence is not only here, but in the world beyond. This was the view we had of ourselves as we expanded west, as we triumphed economically. We began to have, of course, a hemispheric sense of our ordained empire, for good or bad. And so Lane begins to capture that in these beautiful optimistic pictures, as I say, of the mid-1850s. And that continues for the next few years. What is interesting, of course, as we get into the period of the border warfare between Kansas and Nebraska, the Know-Nothing Party in Washington. By the mid-1850s, the regional conflict has become even more and more obvious, more and more tense, as the country begins to reach the threshold of falling apart. For the time being, Lane's pictures continue this sense of radiance, this fascination, for example, with the twilight hour, the idea of this moment of golden light as the sun is setting. This is a kind of painting that suggests to us when the day ends, it's been one of perfection. And the implication of this kind of imagery is that the day to follow will be just as nice, that nature goes through a cycle of constant renewal. The course of empire goes from youth to old age, but then returns to youth again. And so landscape paintings were painting blasted, broken tree trunks, but they were painting them next to fresh, young greenery. This sense, again, of the symbolism of nature's infinite cycle suggested in terms of light, of color, of stillness. These are compositions near perfection in terms of stability, self-confidence, whatever words you want to use. But what is so interesting, and here it comes to the crux of my argument, that by 1860, the end of the 60s, we're now literally on the threshold of tearing ourselves apart. Lane faces this sense of crisis in a couple of ways. And they're kind of fascinating because here you see, for the first time, a painting of a thunderstorm. And it's not, what's interesting is it's not a thunderstorm itself, this painting on the right, 1860. It's called Coming Storm off Owl's Head on the mid-main coast of Penobscot Bay. And Lane has taken the devices of thunderstorm, that is to say, threatening noise, threatening violence, imminent squalls. There is a squall along the horizon there that's rushing forward, and we see the sailors up in the yardarms rushing to take the sails in before the squall line, the hurricane line, comes across the foreground. So Lane has given us a moment before the breaking of the storm and painted it with this stability, as you see, of two vessels against a long horizon line. Again, a very simplified composition, not one of dynamism or turmoil itself, but rather one that is still and precise and orderly, and yet contains, as I say, this sense of imminent noise and visual violence, a kind of perversity, an inverse of the sense of action itself. So in terms of, if there is a subject matter, see, there it is. thank you very much. If there is a subject matter in Civil War landscape painting, it's three things. Not just for the first time, but for the first time in a major way, the shipwreck in marine painting becomes an obsessive subject. I'll show you one by Lane in just a moment. The shipwreck, think about it, in some ways, is now seen as a metaphor for the wreckage or the imminent wreckage of the ship of state. The shipwreck, secondly, the thunderstorm. Up to now, largely American painters, as I say, like Lane himself, 5-10 years before, had painted just radiant sunlight. Sunlight, I would like to say metaphorically as well as literally, America at high noon. But now they begin to paint the sunset as not something fulfilling day's conclusion, but a sense of violence, the flares of fire. And there's all of that imagery running through Thoreau's journals and notebooks, the idea of the not only inner fire, but the fires of nature. And then I'm reminded, of course, of Lincoln's great phrase, the fiery trial through which we are going. So in some ways, I want to argue, and I'll show you now images of this, the idea of the flares, the lurid, intense sunset or twilight pictures becomes a second major subject after the shipwreck. So you have the thunderstorm, the twilight or sunset pictures, and shipwreck. So that's as close as you get, as it were, to a subject matter of conflict. And of course, these are not painted at the moment of Gettysburg or Manassas or any particular, but they do, as I say, have this sense of explosive tension or imminent violence painted visually. And so the lesson here is that we're beginning as art historians to see how landscape adapted to the needs, changing needs, as we move from one moment into another. A couple of other late paintings, early 60s by Lane. Appropriately, he chose a beach that happened to be named, and this is along the Gloucester shoreline, Coffin's Beach. I don't think it's any accident, and it was named Coffin's Beach, obviously, because at low tide, these dark, rocky outcroppings suggested a kind of cemetery. And so Lane seizes on that image, and if you again compare this with what we've just looked at, there's a kind of drained quality. Yes, you've still got that lovely sort of yellow on the horizon of sun setting, but it's as if he's wanting to paint emptiness, paint a kind of drained vacuum. There's something haunting about this picture, or let me use the adjective elegiac. The moon has shifted. Twilight on Penobscot Bay, lumber schooners at twilight on Penobscot Bay, here on the right-hand screen. The same thing, the sunset is in the far distance there in the left-hand corner, left-hand edge, and it's as if light is literally being drained. It seems to me the whole sensibility has changed from just the two or three images I showed you a moment ago. This was Lane's response to this deep period. Many of his family members, he himself was had some kind of polio, we believe, and couldn't serve. But members of his family, like many others in the North, went south to fight. So Lane was now well aware of family loss, of what was happening to the nation itself. And I think this was in part his response. And so the last pictures he painted in 1863-64, his last painting year before his death in 65, isn't it interesting that there's almost an obsession with low tide, with not only light, as it were, at the end of the day being drained from nature, but now the water is receding, that you have him fascinated with these blacks of the exposed rocks at low tide. There's still this exquisite sense of light that we associated with his painting style, but I'm suggesting in his pictorial vocabulary, this image of nothing happening, of the tide being out, hasn't yet turned, that there's something, as I say, deeply poetic, deeply mournful, in which the landscape, as I say, is turned into a kind of visual a cemetery. Which brings me to Lane's last pictures. Now, as I say, he dies in 1865. The last series, I think, quite significantly that he undertook, first of all, you can't tell from images on a screen. These are very small little pictures, perhaps 12 by 15 inches wide, as opposed to the larger landscapes that are double or triple that size. I find it fascinating that Lane concentrates now on the small scale, the intimate scale, the jewel-like scale. I want to say the introspective scale, looking inward. Something deeply, as I say, personal, the horizon line blurred and obscured in a haze of light, as if this is not just an external record, but an internal landscape. You have the pink light. This is a little cove, again, off of Gloucester called Braces Rock. Lane went out there, and for the first time, for an artist who had painted shipping scenery, fishing negotiations, shipbuilding, all of the productive activity of the economy of the sea, which had dominated his work in the 1850s, say coastal trade, for example, now he brings us to the shipwreck or the abandoned vessel. They're very small. The little schooners have been beached, have been left. It's interesting, there's no human presence. Human presence may be implied in that the sails have been taken down. Has this vessel been abandoned or is it washed ashore? We don't quite know. But I do think it's significant that, and it was a series of several, three, four, maybe at the most half dozen, which he experimented with various points of view here. But how different this light is from the earlier images I showed you at the outset, full of radiant light. Now, as I say, there's this very cool sense of the pink light as it's about to disappear into darkness. And the imagery now is of this poignant little vessel, and particularly the one on the right, where you actually see the shell of the vessel itself like a skeleton. I don't think that's any accident. Now, the danger we art historians have, of course, my students accuse me of it all the time, is how to read out of a painting what we think is there as opposed to reading into it what we want it to be there. So I have to be very careful in making this suggestiveness, but it seems to me the visual evidence accumulates to give us that sensibility. Now, the other aspect, of course, I say Lane himself was probably having either some kinds of heart trouble, heart stroke, or whatever in his last year of life as he became increasingly infirm. It's equally possible to argue these little pictures as his own sensibility about mortality, his own coming death. It's not that he knew the moment that it would be the following year, but it seems to me something of the poignance of these pictures, the meditative aspect, the sense of disintegration is both, it seems to me, something that has to do with the larger national situation, as well as something deeply personal, as I say, in his own biography. The second artist, Martin Johnson Heed, often compared to Lane, is actually born a good generation younger, 1819. So he doesn't come to his maturity until the Civil War period, the late 1850s. But he also, interestingly, begins his earliest work, such as you see there, the North Shore of Boston, is largely an open pastoral field, benign landscape, sometimes filled with hunters out in the foreground. And then Heed then, interestingly, chooses for his principal subject matter over the next, good 25 years, but certainly through the next crucial 10-year period, he chooses the marshscape, the marshlands of the North Shore, primarily Newburyport and the Newburyport area. Then later he painted the New Jersey marshes, and finally, after the war, goes to Florida. I find, again, I just want to argue, throw this out for you to think about, I find it fascinating that he chooses the marsh as his principal landscape. Because the marsh, in a sense, by definition, is an unstable landscape. It's neither solid nor liquid, but both. Moreover, it changes every 6 hours with the tide. These were saltwater marshes in which, when the tide was out, these little rivulets would be practically drained. Then they would come in. He'd go out there with carts, trying to get a view before the tide came in and the landscape became unstable. I just wonder whether consciously or not, he chose this landscape to explore because somehow it was related to or could express the larger instability of the national condition. I don't know. We don't have letters to that effect. But the fact is that he made it his subject matter for dozens and dozens of paintings suggest to me that exploration of a particular typology of landscape, as opposed, for example, to Bierstadt wanting to paint the Rocky Mountains as the great symbol of solid, awesome grandeur. The marsh, as I say, in its softness, its changeability, was serving a different kind of need as we move into this period of turmoil. Moreover, and I've organized this almost in an artificial way, as the series proceeds and moves on into the 60s, notice how we have Heed beginning to play with the idea of Lane's idea of the coming storm. And it's quite possible that Heed knew that thunderstorm painting by Lane, because it will be Heed who now makes the thunderstorm between 1859 and 1865, paints a remarkable and dramatic series of thunderstorms, primarily in the New England and the Newburyport landscape. One of the more dramatic here on the right, where we have now this artist like Lane in those last pictures using black as a new expressive color, this drama of light and dark. You have, as you see here, reflections. There's something brooding about these pictures. First of all, they're about the harvesting of hay, but then they move, as I say, into some deeper sensibility. You still have, as you see, a touch of blue sky on this one on the right, but then they culminate. Here are two examples from 1859, 1860. I don't find these thunderstorm pictures accidental. I think he discovered that the thunderstorm now was the perfect visual metaphor for the national conflict. And they're among the most remarkable and powerful pictures painted in America, as I say, in this critical period. Figures doing nothing, water breaking on the shore. But look at the way the waves break there on the left, almost frozen. They're a technical tour de force in the way you have the frozen water there. Or as I say, the black circle literally occupying the whole center of this composition on the right. And then one in Amon Carter Museum on the right-hand screen there, Approaching Storm. He gave them various titles. But the waves on that picture on the left, to me, as I say, almost look like frozen waves. Aside from the storm itself sweeping across these great canvases, this exploration, as I say, in a world of blackness and natural violence became the metaphors by which they could really explore and respond to what was going on. A related aspect I've already suggested in Lane's work. These are pictures of 1862, Spouting Rock near Newport on the right, and on the left, a painting of Lake George. And they're beautiful in many ways, and the slides barely give a hint of this, but I just want to suggest that the way they're painted almost suggests a kind of dryness, particularly that beach in the Lake George picture on the left. When you see it firsthand, it almost looks like a moonscape. Even though there's a little figure in a rowboat there, you seem to be entering into some kind of landscape of a vacuum, of something severe. And so this is another hint, as I say, of a way of finding in the natural world a particular language that could visually express their response. Lane bringing together the thunderstorm there with a wrecked ship offshore occupying center stage in our attention. And as I say, to me, a kind of metaphor, a kind of imagery of the wrecked ship of state. And finally, in one of the most beautiful, you'd say, on the surface, this painting of haystacks at sunrise on the right-hand screen, I call your attention to the little detail of a figure, an old figure, it turns out, in a red shirt in the lower right foreground, seated in a boat with a young boy. And the red-shirted old man, presumably a grandfather, has got a fishing line. On the face of it, it has all of that tranquility, and you'd say this is a contradiction in terms. It's almost a kind of hallucinogenic picture in its stillness, in its mystery of moisture and atmosphere. But what is haunting to me is the fact that the figures that are in this picture are the extremes of age, the old man and youth. So in 1863, here is Heed already, in a sense, painting who is not only there, but more importantly, who is missing. The brother, the father, the soldier who is lying on O'Sullivan and Gardner's battlefields. So these are some of the subtle ways these artists were addressing landscape. And I conclude with just a few images now of perhaps the most powerful figure of this generation, Frederick Edwin Church, younger still, 1826, studied with the great master and the founder of the Hudson River School, Thomas Cole, comes from an ardent Union family, his family very conscious of the outbreak of war, and of, as it were, of saving the Union, saving American nature and nation. On the left is, in fact, a painting by Lane, one of Lane's early sunset pictures, probably the first, Twilight on the Kennebec, which gave Church the idea of working with these, what were then new pigments, the reds and intense yellows, oranges, the so-called cadmium colors, had only very recently been developed as individual pigments available in tubes to artists who could now paint the idea of sunset and twilight. So you have a very interesting moment in the technology of painting that comes together with, as it were, a wish for imagery. And Church seizes, he saw Lane's painting there on the left on exhibition in New York in 1849. The next year, the next summer, Church himself decides to go to the Maine coast and begin painting his sunset and twilight pictures. Sunset off Grand Manan on the right-hand screen. And as I say, as early pictures in the sequence, Church too begins, anchors himself with these images of radiant sunlight. You don't feel threatened yet. You don't feel that imminence of violence. And Church begins to exploit this remarkable vocabulary, as you can see, of red pigments to paint on the one hand dawn off Mount Desert there on the left, Mount Katahdin, the great inland peak in central northern Maine, here on the right. You could argue that dawn is, of course, day's promise. But in turning to sunset on Mount Katahdin, he's interested in that image I suggested a moment ago of the idea of looking westward, that in the westward landscape would be endless promise. Church in this painting of Mount Katahdin really gives us two pictures. On the one hand, the foreground, there are cattle there in the water. There's a boy you can't make out under a tree looking, as it were, into the future. And then in the background, or the upper two-thirds of the canvas, this remarkable, this wonderful, radiant landscape that, as I say, captures all of this great period of optimism before a crisis occurs. By 1856, something new is coming into these pictures, and it's very subtle in that painting on the left that Church simply titled Sunset, some Munson Williams Proctor in Utica. And I just call attention to a couple of elements. All those beautiful pinks and yellows and soft colors that hinted, so to speak, of day's fulfillment, now Church pushes that yellow to an almost acidic quality. In the foreground, across the rocks and the water surface, the pinks have moved to lavenders and purples. Just the shift in the palette alone seems to me suggests a very different mood, in which there's almost a tension introduced into this picture, a tension, again, that is expressed only through color itself. The whole series culminates into one of the masterworks of the of American art at the critical moment, 1860, and it's called Twilight in the Wilderness. It's in the Cleveland Museum, and it is not so much, to use the art historian David Huntington referred to the earlier pictures, as America at a moment of genesis, of promise, and in the making. This is America at a moment of apocalypse. It's not quite Lincoln's fiery trial, but it is now at the threshold of the literal outbreak of war, an awareness of crisis about to explode. A meteorologist will tell us that's a sky, 20, 30,000 feet up, the meteorologists now called a front coming through. We sense in that sky not just an extraordinary cloud configuration, which it is, and a cloudy sunset the Church had seen in Bar Harbor a few years before and sketched, but now turns into a great drama that's neither coastal nor inland Maine, but a combination of what he'd seen on the shore and what he saw wanted to suggest is continental America, America as a whole. On the right, you have these great dying tree trunks, almost gesturing like human beings at the horror, at the imminence of this great drama. It is composed like a piece of theater, a stage on which nature and the sunset is going to be the great protagonist. You can't make out, but I must point out, on the left of it, isolated against the hot reds of those tinged clouds, is an eagle sitting in the branches of the tree. Church intentionally paints this, in other words, as a national picture. This is about the nation at the beginning of crisis. It is also, of course, an American civil war, which you also can't make out in the foreground on this blasted tree trunk in the immediate foreground. Church is painted, the configuration of the blasted stump, and the eye reads it as a figure praying before a cross. This also has, in other words, a religious connotation to it. The biblical challenge to nature is also underway. It's not just the outbreak of the Civil War, it is the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species the year before, which Church had read. The Origin of Species, of course, in an instant challenging, overturning the idea of nature as God's creation, of God's immanence in nature, that nature was haphazard, nature was accidental in its changes and so forth. This is a picture of enormous complexity, subtlety, and expressiveness that, as I say, pushes the buttons not only of nationality, of contemporary history, but also the very challenge to the idea of the biblical underpinnings, at least of American nature. So it is a turning point picture in which, as I say, the elements of the landscape have embodied all of these intellectual, emotional, and social ideas. And if you doubt me, 1860, later that year, Church paints the icebergs. And originally, it was called the icebergs now in the Dallas Museum. And in the foreground, the imagery, of course, of the broken cross there in the foreground, the top of the spar of some abandoned vessel. Now, this does have to do, of course, with northern explorations by the English and the Americans to the Arctic regions. But later that year, Church was commissioned to do a chromolithograph of that painting. And the chromolithograph he intentionally titled The North. He unionizes the picture. There is the threat and the imminence of death in the wilderness, but it is also, of course, the idea of the Arctic as a great pure geology. It is, as I say, Church conscious of the northern landscape as being an American landscape. And then in a kind of sort of nonsensical way, in terms of the Union cause, turned his sunsets that we have just seen, Twilight in the Wilderness, paints again as propaganda, so to speak, a picture called Our Banner in the Sky. And he intentionally did it as a chromolithograph. There is an oil painting, a lithograph which could be reproduced and circulated. And as you see, it's the tattered flag against the twilight sky. So Church in, as I say, if you doubted me, in Twilight in the Wilderness, Church is thinking of it as our, namely, the Union banner in the sky under assault. There are other, finally, remarkable pictures of the mid-1860s that I think, again, are very telling. For example, on the left, a storm at Mount Desert, where we are looking at an afternoon sky almost obscured, like some kind of hurricane or some kind of traumatic event where the sun is about to be obscured, almost a kind of eclipse. And in the foreground, as opposed to those beautiful pictures of like Mount Katahdin of just a few years before, now we have the water bashing the rocks. This has also become a kind of Darwinian battle in which water and rock are physically fighting one another. In other words, the tranquil landscape of the 1850s is now the engaged battlefield of the titanic elemental forces of water and rock of the 1860s. Also 1863, he painted it before, starts going to South America, kind of hemispheric vision of America. It begins, but now he paints in the northern Andes the erupting volcano of Cotopaxi. You barely get a hint of it. The actual picture is even more dramatic in the color contrast, in which you have this sense of liquid fire. The sun itself now in battle with the earth. The explosion of black smoke trying to obscure the background of the picture. This is Church's Gettysburg. This is Church's battlefield. So he was very much attuned, as I say, to what was going on. And finally, just to bring this to conclusion, I hope drive home, the Church of all of these artists is the most eloquent and was recognized at the time. What does he do in 1866? He paints these two pictures, you might say, of acts of thanksgiving. The one on the left, Rainy Season in the Tropics, now in San Francisco, is, of course, this beautiful double rainbow that arches across the chasm and, as it were, metaphorically unites north and south, an act of thanksgiving. On the right is the Aurora Borealis, again, a belief that God has returned to the landscape, this heroic expedition of northern lights, small vessel there in the foreground. So it seems to me when you put these sequences together, we have here as concrete a response, an emotional range from tranquility and optimism through terror and horror to the conclusion of the war years. And so, as I say, it's a battlefield of an entirely different time, something entirely original to this period, both in American art, and I think you can't find any equivalent in European art. Thank you very much. Thank you.